You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
How do we price the protest in China? Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. With me today is Tavi Costa, partner and portfolio manager at Crescat Capital. Hi, Tavi.
Hi, Maggie. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Interesting start to the week. We have U.S. stocks, which just closed, down, bond yields and the dollar up on what seemed like a whole host of concerns. We heard hawkish comments from a couple of Federal Reserve officials, BlockFi, another crypto firm, filed for bankruptcy. And of course, these reports of protests in China all seem like they combine to sort of weigh on sentiment today, kind of creating this risk off environment. What's top of mind for you as we kick off this week?
Well, look, it's been top of my mind, at least, to be looking at the what is likely to be the roadmap for this market, which is mostly of the darlings of this prior cycle are all retesting the COVID lows. And you can look at Chinese stocks, you can look at some software stocks, you can see ARK investments. They're all retesting the COVID 2020 or the March 2020 lows already. Even Amazon, Netflix, Facebook. And there are other parts of the market are yet to, in my opinion, retest those lows. And there's a significant downside from here, in my opinion. So when you have markets right now, showing a relief rally that we had in the last weeks or so. I think it's, in my opinion, when you have those situations, I think you want to systematically increase your short exposure as the market moves higher. And now it looks to me, I don't have a crystal ball, but certainly looks like it's a first day down for most markets, especially this was a very broad sell-off. You look at the equal weighted index in S&P was down over 2% today. And so it's really not driven by one or two sectors. And the other thing I would like to comment is the mega cap side. The mega cap stocks have been underperforming the overall market. And today was another example of that, Apple being one of them. But really across the board, when you look at other companies that are in this mega cap realm, are certainly under tremendous pressure right now. So I think that's the beginning of a trend, not the end of one, and probably we'll likely to see that leading the way to the downside.
Wow. So that sounds like you're pretty bearish. I want to sort of kind of methodically walk through some of it because there's a lot of threads in there. And let's start with China. That's just because of the news we're seeing. I mean, certainly everyone kind of walking into the U.S. session today, looking at the reports of protests. Again, really hard to know exactly what's going on just because of the limited coverage. And even the journalists that are there are really, you know, constrained in their ability to move around and report. But clearly, you know, there seems to be some element of frustration and social unrest and just people fed up with the zero COVID policy. A lot of concerns about supply chains filtering into that. What's your sense of where we are with China in terms of the economy? I mean, is this going to sort of further complicate an already cloudy picture?
I sent to you a chart with the title of Banking Asset Growth, which shows, I think it's probably one of the last charts I sent you on email, which basically shows the growth of Chinese banking assets over time, all the way back to the global financial crisis that completely dwarfs anything that we've seen in other more developed economies. And it's been our view that China is facing a real credit imbalance, perhaps one of the largest we've seen in history. And I think China is much closer to an economic implosion than winning a hegemonic war against the US and other Western nations in general. So, and this is also why I think it's so relevant from a global perspective, just because of the deglobalization trends that will likely intensify as we see this. But the protests politically is something that we haven't seen since the early 90s. And interestingly, is really this situation is not really against the CCP, but really against the Xi Jinping, from my read and from or domestic context that we have in China. It's interesting that some of the leakage of the videos, initially, I think everybody thought that those videos were all intentionally leaked by the CCP. And now I think we're seeing, from my understanding, again, from my context that I have there, that certainly those are real problems that are unfolding in China. The difference here is that back in the early 90s, there was a strong sense of who was going to be the next leader of the party. Today, I don't think we have that at all. So that is a little questionable from a sense of when you know you have a credit imbalance and a monetary crisis unfolding. And how do we know that? Well, just look at the foreign reserves of China that have been declining over time. And a lot of people like to look at that as China having the upper hand of being able to sell treasuries, when it's really the other way around, is China is running out of dollars in this case. And so in my opinion, I think the big question here is how is Xi Jinping going to try to reestablish its credibility in terms of its leadership? And so that could come in through nationalism. You know, Taiwan could be in a target here. That could be come in through Tiananmen Square type of event, similar to what we saw in the early 90s. But remember, back in the 90s as well, we had to restructure the Chinese banks, which is a little bit similar to what we have today, given the fact there's so many non-performing loans in the banking assets of China and Hong Kong as well. And given that, back in 93, 94, we've had a devaluation of the Chinese yuan of 33% on one day. I think that that's sort of a black swan event that not a lot of people were really positioned for. That's the definition of a black swan. And so we're short the Chinese yuan. We've been short one of the longest hedge funds that actually been betting against that. It's been a long ride for us, and it worked a few years. It didn't work other years. And I think if there was ever a time to be short the Hong Kong dollar, the time is today.
Yeah, it's just so fascinating, Tavi, because China is so important to the global economy. We know what happened when we're talking about the supply chains. So I think it's really important, this risk that you're pointing out. And for those who are members of Real Vision, you know that we've been watching China very closely. It was part of our Make or Break series. I encourage you to go back and listen to the interview that I did with Victor Xi. He's an associate professor at UC San Diego. And I want to play a little clip of that because, you know, trying to figure out how to navigate through both the economic challenges they face and how to get out of this zero COVID policy, or do they get out of it, has been a real concern for many of the China experts we talked to, including Victor. And he really laid out what are a series or scenarios, all of which are highly problematic. Let's have a listen to part of that conversation.
Right now, the big connection is Hong Kong. I mean, despite everything, Hong Kong continues to be a major bridge between the Chinese financial system and the global one. They can always shut it down. And if they shut it down, then it's fine. I mean, basically, you know, people just can't take money out of China at all. And then they will do this thing where they limit the number of students who can travel overseas, the number of tourists who can travel overseas, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, we hope it doesn't get to that point. You know, obviously, we like having our students from China, you know, coming studying with us and paying tuition, et cetera. But it could come to that, you know, if the outflows are too. Because I think the alternative, which is kind of a clean float and, you know, open up the capital account, the cost of that is just too high for China, because basically you will have this kind of 30%+ depreciation overnight. And then the problem with that is the dollar value of China's economy also shrinks by 30%. And China will never catch up with the United States, which for Xi Jinping, that's unacceptable. So I think for him, he would rather have kind of a closed system that he can claim is like, oh, but we're getting more powerful, we're getting richer, even though the accounting of it is very suspect because, you know, it's completely closed loop.
And that full interview is available to members on our website. If you want to get access to it, go ahead and head over to our website. Sometimes you have a QR code up too. I don't know if we have that up today, but easy to find. Tavi, exactly what you were talking about, this strikes me as, you know, both of those scenarios very difficult, but the idea of a devaluation or the Hong Kong dollar losing its peg, I mean, talk to me about what that would mean for the global economy. These seem like huge events, and if they're not being priced in, why aren't they being priced in?
Well, I think it's a little bit of hubris from my end to be, you know, looking to short the Hong Kong dollar, knowing how many decades it's been pegged against the dollar here. But it's, you know, if you look at the fundamentals of a currency, there's a good paper that refers to basically all the fundamentals and metrics you should be looking at to short a currency. And essentially, you know, there's a kind of a checklist of things that you should be watching for, regardless if it is FX reserves declining, FX reserves relative to money supply, the banking assets growth, and then look at the banking assets relative to GDP. All those things in China and Hong Kong actually check in terms of the risk for devaluation of those currencies. It's been a review as well that it's difficult to express that opinion in markets. In the Hong Kong dollar, it's fairly easy. And throughout history, when you look at other times when we've had big monetary crises in other countries and other monetary systems in the past, what actually happens is most of the times you may see a collapse in equity markets alongside with collapse of the currency versus the dollar. But the usual pattern is that you tend to see gold prices in local currency terms to rise. So it's tangible assets relative to the local currency that tends to be repriced at much higher levels. And so I think that that's sort of what's going on here. And if you think about the history of China itself, there are many, in the last century, China had to reset its monetary system about 9 times. In other words, literally their currency went to zero and they had to reset the monetary system with a new currency. And so China does have a history of having issues like what we have currently. And so, which makes me believe that I don't think this is fully priced in. The CNH volatility, implied volatility, is a little higher than used to be. Call it, you know, 3 years ago. Now, the Hong Kong dollar implied vol is still very, very low, which allows a fund like ours to have a significant exposure to short the Hong Kong dollar relative to the U.S. dollar over time without actually having to risk a lot of premium.
Hey, everyone, we're going to take a quick break right now to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Yeah, very, very interesting. And again, you know, I just think it's important to sort of put this on everyone's radar. You know, I think Tavi, I don't think anyone's saying this is happening tomorrow, but these are the, all of you I know look at the probability, you know, and the risks that you have to be aware of and trying to sort of figure out, you know, maybe what's not being paid enough attention to. And so I think it was really important to kind of start that conversation. We asked the question, how do you price this crisis? I don't know if any of us know, Tavi, but you would be looking at the Hong Kong dollar as sort of an interesting aspect to watch, correct?
Yeah, I mean, and we've been in that trade for a while, so I don't want to say that I have necessarily an edge on when it's going to happen. I do think it's very important, sort of an insurance policy in our portfolio, to have that exposure. If that happens, to your initial question, that would be a risk-off scenario. That would be a shock to the world.
Yeah.
That would likely be a shock to equity markets in the U.S. And I don't think that would be actually perceived as positive for the global economy in general, because usually a large collapse of a currency tends to also precede other political changes in an environment like that. And you know how authoritarian and communist China really is. And you know, who knows who could be the next leader. And those are the big questions that we don't have answers for, because there's not really a well-defined, you know, next leadership in place at all. And yeah, we know the pressure is severe. And with Xi Jinping today to actually leave, you know, his role as the leader of the party.
Yeah. Okay. I'm so glad it was worth taking the time to talk about this. Well, you have this general sense of unease. This is why. I mean, these are big, very big, very risky problems. We're going to have to see how it plays out, but it's really worth putting on everyone's radar. So thank you for that. And by the way, Fred Croft is asking a question. I'm going to just say, Fred, I'm going to refer you to both Victor and George Magnus's interviews we did in that series. He's asking about Beijing's attempt to shift liability to the regions in terms of the real estate situation. Both of those guests talked about that as another underappreciated risk, the idea that there's, you know, that the money transfers from the central government aren't happening in the way they were before. So there's sort of financing issues that are going to create even more tension in some of those peripheral cities, not the big ones, but the sort of mid-sized to smaller cities. Very, very interesting conversation. So, Fred, you can go maybe find some more information in both of those interviews on that issue. Okay, so let's move it back here, Tavi. I mentioned Fed governors out banging the hawkish drum again, saying higher rates are going to be needed. Clearly, keep trying to walk the market back from, you know, looking for any kind of sign of a pause. What are you watching in terms of the Federal Reserve? We're going to have Jay Powell speaking on Wednesday.
Well, look, I think it's a lot of attention on the rate changes and the sort of potential for a pivotal moment on how interest rates will be in terms of terminal rates and Fed funds rates in the next months or so. And if we're going to see a change from 75 to 50 and from there, what happens, and that could potentially be people saying that could potentially be positive for equity markets. But in my opinion, what is even more relevant is what's happening on the balance sheet. The balance sheet size, number one, you know, when we look at the size of the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve today, it is completely overstated. And that is because when you calculate on a mark-to-market basis, accounting technicality here, the decline in prices of the Treasury market has been severe. It is probably about 1.3 to $1.5 trillion that is actually mismarked in the balance sheet as of today. So the tightening of or the depletion of the reserves from the Federal Reserve has actually been larger than what's been reported. The second thing is the rate of change of this depletion as well, which you can look at that on a weekly basis, which is reported, I think, every Thursday afternoon. And you can see that right now they're selling somewhere close to $40 billion a week. And that is severe. $40 billion of quantitative tightening is something we have never seen in the past. That is despite all the weakness that we see in the macro data, which is something I've been covering very closely. We have the Federal Dallas Manufacturing Index that came out today, for instance. New orders to collapse today to levels that we only seen in lockdowns and global financial crisis. And people need to be paying attention to those examples, because those analogs were times when the Federal Reserve actually had completely changed and actually provided a significant amount of relief for markets by providing support by either doubling the size of the balance sheet, dropping rates to zero, quite the opposite than what we have today. The rate of change of the balance sheet itself is actually getting increasing in terms of the decline of their assets. And so I think that's a very important point to be made, which is related to liquidity. And I think liquidity is getting is about to change significantly. One thing is to take interest rates to 4%. When you go above that, you start seeing some real signs of weakness in the global economy. And I think we're about to see that.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of people have been looking at the yield curve being inverted as a sign that, you know, recession's coming. I know you have a chart of these yield curve inversions that you sent over you know, what are you anticipating for the economy? Is it going to be a severe recession? What do you see happening?
Well, Maggie, I think that's a very important debate in the macro community, and a healthy debate of, is this a mid-cycle sort of pause, or are we seeing the beginning of a steeper recession? And I like to use some of my best indicators, which to answer that question, which is what you just said, is the percentage of yield curve inversions. I think there's a lot of smart people looking at yield spreads out there, the 10-year versus the 3-month yield, 10-year yield versus 2-year yields. And once those invert, they tend to tell you similar signals that you are about to see a contraction of growth. And this percentage of inversions is just a much more comprehensive way of analyzing the entire treasury curve, where you're really looking at all possible spreads of the treasury curve between the 30 years all the way to overnight rates. And you make all the combinations that you can, which is, I think, is about 45, and you calculate how many of those are actually inverted. And empirically, as you can see in the chart, every time we go above 70% of the measurement, it coincided with the recession. And then I went a little deeper on that thought because I wanted to know, what does it mean to a portfolio? How do you position when you have that 70% of inversions? And what it means is that you want to own gold and sell stocks. It's the gold to S&P 500 ratio. There are times where that ratio is really driven by gold prices rising, and there are times that it's really driven by a collapse of equity markets where gold holds its ground relative to risky assets. And there are times as well when you have the two parts of this trade working. In other words, gold rising along with equity markets declining. I think this is sort of the playbook that we have currently. Mm. When I look at the commodity space and I see, you know, energy has played a very big role in the last 1 or 2 years, two back-to-back incredible performances. And I think about owning baskets of commodities in general in our portfolio, because that's what we believe. We think we're entering an inflationary era. I think the precious metals is going to actually lead the way right now in this commodity side of our portfolio. And that's mostly driven by this weakness in global economy and really because of this yield curve inversion signal that is provided by this research. And so I'm very focused. I think the mining sector, mining companies, and most of precious metals in general can actually lead the way to the upside relative to other commodities, which has been lagging other commodities, especially the cyclical ones. Mm. And I think that's going to be an interesting setup.
That is an interesting setup.
We're going to take another quick break to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Bo is asking about, how do you feel about inflation, saying, I'm most concerned with food inflation, bad growing seasons, diesel, fertilizer, China's massive imports. But you're looking at higher inflation across the board. Are you in the camp that believes we're in an elevated period of inflation?
Well, look, I think we're entering an inflationary era. That doesn't mean we could see a wave. I think it's going to develop in waves of inflations where, you know, similar to the 70s, we've had three waves. And if you look at the CPI rates, it did higher lows in that measurement. So have we seen the first wave? You know, probably. I think markets are already pricing in the probability that we've seen that. So that's, you know, that's one thing to be looking at. But I don't think, you know, I think you have to look at what are the causes of this inflationary problem. And I call it the pillars of inflation, because I think they're very relevant to this discussion. Number one, it's the wages and salaries growth, which usually are secular moves. And I think we're at the very beginning of that shift, and similar to how we saw back in the 70s. Secondly, I think it has to do with natural resources in general. I was one of the few people that actually put those charts of CapEx of most natural resources 3 years ago, really looking at CapEx for energy companies, CapEx for most of the mining companies. and seeing that those cycles are very clear. When you hit those lows historically, especially adjusted for GDP levels, that tends to cause a shortage of raw materials in general. And so I think we're in that position yet. We are not, the tightening of monetary conditions is only making this this problem worse. I mean, I invest in a lot of mining companies. I can see firsthand how much those companies are suffering to actually attract liquidity so they can invest in new projects of exploration.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's not overnight. Claire and folks, if you, I think we have an S&P 500 metals and mining index that Tavi sent over, and you can really see the, you know, the chart and the fact that you kind of feel like it's at sitting at one of those bottoms, right? That it's, We've been getting a lot of questions about that, but do you feel like it's going to turn? Because there's been a lot of sort of frustration, hasn't there, in the gold and silver space that, you know, everybody kind of thinks it should be really performing well in this environment, but it kind of hasn't been able to do that. So are we finally past that, or are there challenges?
Look, I think so. Until 2 months ago, silver was having its worst year in 30 years in terms of year-to-date performance. The rate of change from ultra easy to hawkish has been more severe than we've seen in any of the last, you know, call it 30 plus years. So while we're seeing inflation as a problem, and which questions the underperformance of precious metals, on the other side, we're also seeing a Federal Reserve that is committed to reducing the inflation problem. And so it is interesting, you know, how gold and silver have behaved. I think silver as a risky asset has behaved much more poorly than gold. If you look at gold relative to global bonds that have been collapsing, gold has actually held its ground very well. You look at gold relative to TIPS, treasury, inflation protected securities, which also collapse. And you think about that, Maggie, TIPS are designed to protect you against inflation, and that security itself completely collapse as we've seen inflation rise. Even things like the Japanese yen and gold were actually had a very strong correlation. I'm referring to gold versus the dollar and the Japanese yen versus the dollar. Those two also had a strong correlation, and now we're seeing a break of those. And so there is a sense of accumulation of the asset over time, while the pessimism in terms of, I would say, most of the sentiment in precious metals has been very bad. And Wall Street Journal put out a cover of their newspaper the other day saying that gold lost its reserve status and so forth. And so certainly we're seeing a big change here. And the crypto market, which has stole gold's lunch and precious metals lunch in the past, is definitely in a very different place than it was 1 or 2 years ago. So I'm really thinking that gold is going to play a role here in terms of doing what it did in the 70s, which was playing a defensive role as an asset and being a larger percentage of portfolios than it is today. So today, most portfolios are still very long equities and bonds. You know, I don't think that that's going to be the case in the next 10 years. I think it's going to be a mix. And I think gold is going to play a big role into becoming more of a defensive aspect of any portfolios that we see, especially from large capital allocators. And central banks will be forced to likely buy gold in order to improve the quality of their international reserves, which I think is going to also be a big part of all this.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Certainly everyone's kind of rethinking the 60-40 that just blew up in everyone's face this year. So, you know, it's coming at a time when people are taking a kind of fresh look at how they should position. King Louis on YouTube asking, do you think gold and silver would act as a hedge if there was a currency problem in China?
I would think so. I think especially, you know, what we like to do is, you know, there are times when gold can actually sell off in sort of that risk-off environment where you have equity markets declining along with the CNH devaluing relative to the dollar, where you have this kind of strong dollar situation. We're not dollar bears. I mean, we're long gold and tangible assets. But we think it's important to be long those assets relative to the most overvalued currencies in the world. So if you're long the miners, if you're long precious metals in general, and you also have shorts in the Hong Kong dollar and the Chinese yuan, essentially or mathematically, you are long gold relative to those currencies. I think those are the most attractive ways of doing this.
I have to ask you about US stocks before we go, because all of this sounds like you're setting up a picture where you're pretty bearish about the prospect for US equities. Is that across the board or is that concentrated in the sort of mega cap and some of the tech names?
I think it changed over time. I think back in 2021, we were very bearish, especially with software stocks. I wish I would have shorted some of the crypto things. I didn't do enough. I think this year we came in very focused on mega caps. We thought mega caps were going to underperform. I think we've seen pockets of that already happening. And you asking the question that is the most important one, what's next? I think Apple is one example of a company from the mega cap side that has been benefiting tremendously from cheap labor and also a more globalized environment, which I don't believe we're entering in the next 5 to 10 years. And so if you ever want to express the deglobalization side of things, I think you want to be short Apple. Microsoft is another example of that as well in terms of valuations, very similar to what we saw back in the tech bubble peak. And so there's a lot of mega cap names that remain very overvalued relative to the overall markets. I think consumer discretionary continues to be very interesting as a short. And more importantly, I think corporate bonds are also very attractive as a short because you have credit spreads being very low at a time when NASDAQ is already down close to 30%+. And I've never seen a time when you have credit spreads at, you know, call it sub 2% relative to the treasury yields. And in a time when NASDAQ is down 30%+. So I think there's a potential, now again, probability terms, I think that there's a probability that is higher than expected that credit spreads could actually spike as we see things develop. So I'm bearish in equity markets in the US. I've been bearish for a while and I hedge that by being long commodities in general and tangible assets. And that basket of commodities, it changes over time. And now I think it's time to be allocating more into metals because they have really lagged, especially the precious metals have really, really lagged energy, agricultural commodities, and others.
Fascinating stuff. Tavi, my takeaway from this is that it seems like you think the market is being a little bit complacent about the risks out there.
Well, I think we've seen a duration type of repricing where interest rates went higher in the 10-year yields and Fed funds rate and markets have got a little ahead of themselves. And then we saw a sell-off in overall markets. But I don't think we've seen yet that contraction of earnings being reflected in markets. I don't think we've seen a contraction of cash flows and so forth being reflected in prices. And so, you know, I'm skeptical about that. And I think there's a lot of companies that are still trading at very hefty multiples, historically speaking, relative to their own history, in fact. And I don't think they deserve that. And so I have issues with that in general. I think there are parts of the market that are cheap, you know, and most of them are in natural resources. I'm very, very deep into mining in general, because that's where our niche has been now. But I think there are, you know, places to invest in emerging markets. And I think there are places to invest in even other parts of the commodities cycle as well.
Tavi, fantastic stuff. We hit a lot. We could keep going, but we're out of time. But please come back again. Really fascinating thesis. And it sounds like we need to all fasten our seatbelts. It's going to be a little bit rocky, especially if you still have a lot of exposure long U.S. equities. So be careful out there.
Yeah, it's my view. Thank you for having me.
Tavi, great stuff. Thank you so much. Thanks to all of you for joining. We'll be back again tomorrow, same time with Tony Grier. In the meantime, take care and good luck out there.
What's up, revolutionaries? Thanks for tuning in to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. For more content like this, head over to realvision.com and get unfiltered access to the very best, brightest, and biggest names in finance.